I'm Terry Thornton. I'm Curator of Education. I'm very happy to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. I hope most of you are familiar with the program. If you're not, I invite you to visit the website. There will be 9 more lectures after tonight. We do 10 in the fall and 10 in the spring, so I invite you back. In fact, next week we will have the artist John Beach here. John Beach is based in Brooklyn. He's an incredible artist. He's represented by Peter Bloom in New York, so you can find some of his work there. Again, you can visit the website, and there's some information on him. One of the things that I find wildly interested is that in 2007, he collaborated with the playwright Edward Elby on a book, Obscure Reveal. I invite you to look into John's work and come back and join us next week. Tonight, we begin our series again with the artist Uta Barth. Uta is a longtime resident of L.A. She was born in Berlin and came to this country in her early teens. She taught for some time at UC Riverside and continues to do lectures throughout the U.S. and Europe. I have admired Uta's work for some time now. Her photographs absolutely hold me spellbound with their beauty and their mystique, notably favoring how we see over what we see. It is no surprise that this quality has won Uta an illustrious career with an international exhibition record that includes venues such as the Whitney, the Guggenheim, the Museum of Modern Art in New York, the Museum of Contemporary Art, and the Los Angeles County Museum in L.A., the Center for Curatorial Studies at Bard College, the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago, the Wexner Center, the Diepel Foundation in Amsterdam, and the Tate Modern in London, just to name a few. She has received 2 NEA fellowships, the 2004 Guggenheim and the 2008 Broad Art Foundation USA Artist Fellowship. In 2000, the Henry Art Gallery in Seattle had a survey exhibition of Uta's work that some of you may have seen, because then in 2001 it traveled to the CAM in Houston, so I hope some of you were able to see that work. She is currently working on a solo exhibition that will be opening this year, I think it is in May, at the Art Institute of Chicago, with some new exciting work, as well as the exhibition 1979-1982, also this year at Seas and Hoke, which is her gallery in Dusseldorf, and To Walk Without Destination, To See, Only to See, at her Stockholm gallery, Andrean Shepchenko. And then in New York, Uta's gallery is Tanya Bondeker, who was very kind in helping me to get her here tonight. There are 8 beautiful monographs of Uta's work published since 1995 to the present, 2 of which are signed and available in the Modern store. I hope you were able to see them tonight and pick one up. If not, they will still be available after the lecture, although the bookstore is not open directly after the lecture. You can come back and get that. Maybe next week when you come back for John Beach. The 2 that we have are Uta Barth, which is by Fiden Press, with an interview between Uta and Matthew Higgs, selections of Uta's own writings and essays by Pamela M. Lee and Jeremy Gilbert Roth. Most recently published, the absolutely stunning, kind of takes your breath away, be careful when you pick it up and you open it, book titled Uta Barth, The Long Now, a 383-page book with the most gorgeous color plates you've ever seen, and essays by Russell Ferguson, Holly Myers, and Jonathan Crary. And I'm quoting Jonathan Crary here too, in this introduction. In his essay, he says he's a bit of a scholar on perception, which is, of course, why he's writing about Uta's work. And in his essay, he says, "She, Uta, offers us both the immediacy and the otherness of a visual world that is beyond certainty and sameness, beyond opacity and or clarity." So tonight we are fortunate to have with us Uta Barth, who is here to talk about the work and ideas that have developed in her 20-year career. Please join me in welcoming Uta Barth.
Oh, the beginning of lectures is always the hard part. But I would like to begin by thanking Terry for inviting me, for hosting me, for taking care of me, for making all the arrangements for me, and for being an incredibly great person to spend time with in the little off hours that I've had between doing studio visits. I'd like to thank John for patiently figuring out all the technical issues that we had with the projection, which for my work is always very difficult because my work is so ephemeral and so hard to capture in reproduction that doing these kinds of lectures is a challenge for everybody and anybody, and it depends on what kind of projector you have. And John was just like unbelievably patient and skilled at solving all the problems, and now we have a really, really good, as good as it gets representation. I also want to thank the graduate students that I had the pleasure to meet with today. It was my pleasure. It was not my obligation. It was my pleasure. When I travel, I always like meeting with students. I like seeing what people are doing in different parts of the country. And I learn a lot from you, and I learn what I think myself when I'm asked to articulate it in relationship to your work. So thank you for having me in your studio, and I wish I could be here longer and see everybody, but the scheduling sort of didn't allow for that. Given that, I have a couple disclaimers that I have to start every lecture with. And I want to thank all of you for being here. I know this is like a weird weather time, and people are like skittish about being out, and I'm skittish about being able to get a flight out, and so thank you for coming. I'm hoping that I'll be able to fly home. And thank you for indulging the history of my work that I'm going to show you. I'm going to start very, very early on and go to the very present. One of the disclaimers that I always have to do about my work is that since my when I got out of graduate school, I had to do a lot of soul searching, and I came to the conclusion for myself that if I was interested in visual art, which is a very modernist idea, actually, people always write about me as a postmodern modernist, which probably fits. Or it's a very essentialist kind of idea. So I thought, like, if I'm interested in visual art, I should be interested in the visual. I'm not interested in narrative. I'm not interested in metaphor. I'm not interested in symbolism. I'm interested in visual perception. I'm interested in rendering the subtleties and the ephemeral and the things that we see that we don't see or don't notice. I'm interested in the phenomenology and the opticality of the world that we live in. And I'm interested in immersing myself in vision as a visceral experience of being in the moment and giving myself over to it as a way of being in the moment and a way of being in the world. My influences, I've taught for a very long time. I've taught for over 20 years, and I've taught photography. But my influences are not people like Edward Weston or Walker Evans or Lee Freeland or actually really anybody in the history of photography. I'm influenced by people like Robert Irwin, a little bit James Turrell. I'm interested in John Cage, who understands that in order to talk about silence, you need to bracket it with sound or action. I'm interested in Brian Eno, who's interested in peripheral sound, peripheral experience, peripheral, the idea of the peripheral, rather than, you know, the subject itself. And I'm this odd duck. When I'm in museum collections or when I'm doing a museum show, most of the time it'll be in the art department rather than the photography department, because the photography department doesn't care about what I do very much. The history of photography is full of a practice where the camera is used as a pointing device. You take your camera, you walk into the world, and you point it at something beautiful or something significant or something startling or a spectacle or whatever. But you are out there seeking a subject, and you're pointing your camera at something, and usually the subject and the content of the image are one and the same. In my work, that's not true. I'm not interested in the subject. In fact, I'm interested in what happens when you have no subject, or when the subject is air, or vacuum, or silence, or time. So the tropes that run through the work have to do with time, have to do with silence, have to do with visuality, have to do with immersion in the moment, and not with quote-unquote reading a work of art, which we're all taught to do, how to decipher something in terms of symbolism or metaphor or narrative and all of those things. My work is not to be approached to be seen in that way. It's made to be experienced, and in the process of making it to be experienced, it is very object-oriented work. So the images that we're going to show, which are as good as humanly possible, you have the best projector and the best projectionist I've seen yet, but actually seeing a work of mine, there's a lot of attention. A lot of the pieces are like three-dimensional. They're on like deep panels. The surface is perfectly matte, so you can't see any kind of reflection, and it becomes unclear. When you look at a matte surface, it's unclear where the surface is, so there's a sense of depth, or this illusion of depth, and so you're looking into the image instead of at this sort of shiny Kodak surface of photo paper. And I'm very, very, very invested in the objectness of the images and making them a perceptual experience the way that I experience the world. I photograph things that are, well, maybe we should start at this point. Please feel free to ask questions at any time. It's helpful to me, you know, maybe helpful to you. It's definitely helpful to me to know where we're going and we're on. Okay. We're having problems. Sorry. Why is this? Okay. This is an installation shot of the very first exhibition I ever had. I had no gallery. I was just out of graduate school, and I had a solo show at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. And it was this emerging, you know, exhibition series. And the work that I was making at that time was involved in thinking about vision, thinking about opticality, thinking about after images and retinal kind of events, and thinking about being the subject of a photograph or as being the subject of vision, and seeing and rendering vision as invasive and almost hostile. Sorry, I'm having a hard time with this remote. I'll get used to it in a second. So these groupings of images are fairly large scale, and this was the sort of heydays of postmodernism. So the tropes that were in discourse were appropriation, and The Discourse of the Gays. The Discourse of the Gays, of course, interested me both as a woman and as an artist, as somebody who was talking about seeing and being seen and thinking about what it means to be seen and what it means to be seeing. But I wanted to break down the hierarchy between what was a photograph, what was a found image, an appropriated image, which most everything at that point was, what was a painting, what was a media image. So I made images. These configurations are made out of images that I made in my studio that I shot myself. The optical graphics are paintings that are like pure matte black to match the matte black of the photo paper. It's like really matte surfaces. I always use matte surfaces because they have the sense of depth, and you can't comb your hair in the reflection of it. It's like I never like that when people do that in museums of my work. And obviously all of the images in one way or another reference seeing and being seen. You know, in this case, the image on the far right is, you know, from the Buñuel film. And I tried to buy one from an ophthalmologist's office, and they wouldn't let me because of privacy rights. So that's actually my own eyeball that is held open by these retractors to be photographed. Interesting experience. But all of this work strings together an arbitrary set of images that are about vision and about light and about seeing and being seen. And they also begin the play with the idea of the after image, which I'm still engaged with 20 years later. So what would happen is you would look at these like painted graphics, and they would be so retinal. I don't know if you've ever looked at a real Bridget Riley painting, but you know they dance in the air, they vibrate, they move, and then whenever you look at a blank wall, you see the opposite of it. You see the absolute negative of it because of this retinal fatigue for the receptors of one color, so you see the opposite color. In this case, it was just in black and white, but like the black and white images would start vibrating and stuff like that, which is hard to render in a slide presentation, but I was interested in how you carried one image over to the next image, and I would construct these things in, you know, these non-linear kind of configurations and hope that people wouldn't think about narrative. Our natural human instinct is to always read narrative. We always want narrative. No matter how hard you fight against it as an artist, people want narrative. And I thought that by inserting these like optics and making these sort of strange or awkward configurations, I could undermine the idea of narrative. I'm not sure if that's ever entirely possible because people do what they want to do no matter what. But that was my thinking. That was in my intention, is to get rid of the narrative. And this, for example, is an image. When you look at the painting of the concentric circles, which just like vibrate and produce colors that don't exist, but are produced for your eye because your eye just can't focus on anything that like tightly, you know, painted. Then you looked at the next image, which is a magnifying glass. The first painted image would just like create an optical after image that would carry over onto the magnifying glass image, which then would carry over to the next thing, etc. And I was interested in rendering vision as invasive, as scrutiny, as blinding, as something visceral. You know, for me, I hate to be photographed, and I think it's because I'm a photographer. But it's to be photographed, somebody else suddenly owns the representation of who you think you are, and they can do whatever they want with them. And it's an incredibly powerful act. And even when I get approached by magazines that are doing reviews or articles that always want like an image of the artist, I resist at all cost because it's giving away so much power, because that image can then appear in so many other contexts and make so many other meanings that I have no control over. I can have control over who I am and how I live my life and how I speak to you and how I go through the day, but I can have no control over what somebody does with my image. And it's not vanity. It's just like a true, like, physical sense of invasion when I am being photographed. Not everybody shares that. I know people who love to be photographed. Okay, fast forward. Again, another image when you stare at the optical painting and then you stare at the image of me in the spotlight, you see this after image and they meld together, which is impossible, you know, to replicate on the screen here, but you can imagine or get some idea. This is a piece that is about 16 feet long, 10 feet high, and it is simply a film leader, that which precedes every piece of film that you'll ever see in a theater, but you don't see it. And I was interested in looking at and collecting the things that the visual kind of information that brackets narrative and storytelling and you know, a film. I'm interested in the curtain going up. I'm interested in the countdown leader for the film more than I'm interested in the film. I'm interested in that anticipation of a visual event and this waiting for something to start or this closure of something to end. I love end crawls. The end crawl is like the credits at the end. And, you know, it's like I talked to a friend of mine the other day and I was like, have you seen this film? It had the most incredible end crawl. And they were going like, are you insane? Like, what are you talking about? You know, like, aren't they all the same? And I said, like, no, I have a whole collection of them. And, you know, like, I tape them. And, you know, end crawls are really interesting because they're like this point of closure. And they have all these other kind of connotations. But so this is the countdown. And the end crawl comes at the end, as the name would imply. This is not forwarding. Having some technical difficulties here. Okay. Oops. We went a lot forward. Let's try to go back. What happened with that black and white body of work was that it was written about quite a bit, and it was written about almost exclusively in the terms and language and theory of the gaze, the feminist kind of deconstruction of women being represented, and the power of the male gaze. And as a woman at that period of history, I was interested in that discourse, but it was sort of like a sliver of what I was interested in. I was interested in many, many other things, and I was interested in things that were less cognitive and more experiential than just that. And so I had to figure out a way to get away from this sort of politicized, analytical, political statement and make work that was about vision, because I wanted to make work that really was truly about vision, about visual experience, visual engagement, visual beauty, visual, the love of the visual, or, you know, whatever. So the first move was to move to color. Black and white in those days was associated. We live in a different time now, but in those days, all newspapers were printed in black and white. So anything that was black and white had the tinge of the factual, the documentarian. Anything that was in color were like calendars and advertisements and things like that. So now newspapers are in color and it all shifts. But black and white was always the signifier of the authenticity of, you know, the document. And so I moved to color, minimal color. I chose yellow because it's actually the most difficult color to work with. And also maybe because it's also like, you know, sort of a color that refers to light. And I kept making these configurations of images, but the images became less about vision being invasive and more about visual pleasure. The idea of, if you're interested in vision, or if you start thinking about vision, vision is attracted by beauty. And in those days, beauty was a dirty word. I would go give a lecture, and the first question would always be like, oh, could you talk about beauty in your work? And that was a way of saying, like, you know, something very, very bad and hostile to me, because beauty was the dirty word. Beauty was completely, you know, on the outs and unallowable, and it was the frosting and decor and giving over to, you know, or not having the sort of rigor and integrity of this intellectual kind of deconstructive work that was being made. But vision is attracted to beauty. Vision follows beauty, and there are these weird kinds of things that happen when you start thinking about vision and your own visual experiences. Like, you know, you think about like okay, you go travel, you go to a new place, you drive through Arizona. The landscape looks fantastic. It looks just incredible, because you've never seen it before. And that is because the brain works very much like a motion detector. The brain has a map. Anything that it's seen before and seen repeatedly, like your own home, for example, which I photograph later on, it lays the map, and it doesn't really see it. It only sees what changes. But when we travel, everything changes. Everything is new. Everything has not been seen before. And so all these little neurons are firing in our brain, and I have a minor in neurobiology, so I can talk about this a little bit. And there's no, like, they can't find the distinction between the optical nerve and the brain, you know, right? So the eye and the brain are sort of like one and the same. So visual beauty, at this time when it was a dirty word, was what I went to. And then later, you know, a couple years later, I mean, it was in the air. It was, you know, it's not to say that I, like, sort of staked out this territory that nobody else would go to. Later on, like within a couple of years, Dave Hickey was writing about beauty, and Jeremy Gilbert Roth wrote Beauty and the Sublime. And you know, theorists started, you know, sort of doing the backlash to the really dire, sort of rigorous, didactic kind of postmodern deconstructive kind of work, and playing, you know, opening up towards the idea of the visual again, which obviously visual art has always dealt with the visual, or I think should deal with the visual. I think if you, I have no problem with, I look at politically motivated work, and I admire and respect the artist's intention in making it. But honestly, I have political convictions, and I act on them, and I act on them in a political venue, in a political arena, not in the art world, because the art world is not an effective place to produce political change or social change. The art world is like preaching to the choir when you're dealing with political ideas. So when I have, you know, when my own political convictions are being challenged, I go into the world that they're being enacted in, and I, you know, intervene in that way and not in my own work, because I think it's not an efficient medium for that. I act as an activist, political activist, rather than as an artist who makes political work. No disrespect to artists who make political work, but I just don't think it's the most efficient way to address those things. There's been lots and lots of talk about my work being out of focus. I always say, like, my work is perfectly in focus. It's focused on a plane that is not occupied by anything, and what you're seeing is the background of where it's in focus. And people talk a lot about making this big shift from this sort of multi-panel work, which is a little bit, has a sort of, like, still to me has this, like, didactic sting to it that I wanted to get rid of, to moving to making these completely out-of-focus images. But the out-of-focus images actually start in this early work. Like, for example, this, like, field of, like, daisies and butterflies in the bottom right, you know, is out of focus. It's shot out of focus, out of a magazine. And so the quote-unquote out-of-focusness occurs much earlier than people give credit to. The image of the curtain, I had a Terry was saying that I had a retrospective at the Henry, and at the Henry we had 8 rooms for each body of work, and having a retrospective is a really enlightening and a really traumatic thing. You, first of all, you know, I have slides of all my work and I see it all the time, and but still, walking through it room by room, I saw these things. I saw that, first of all, every body of work had a curtain in it. So the curtain is this, like, iconography that, like, just carries on throughout everything that I do, including, like, the most recent thing that I'm doing for the Chicago Art Institute. And you also see, and I could also see in every room which piece was the taking off point for the next body of work. It became really clear. I could look around the room and I say, like, that piece was the beginning of this other idea that was a separate body of work. I've never made single images. I just make bodies of work. I make projects. I can't figure out what to do with single images. So it, you know, in this thing of, like, seeing your own retrospective, you could really see, like, how you got from one place to the next, which at the time of doing it, I had not a clue about. But walking through the museum, it was just like here, 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 and here, which is a nice and nice opportunity to see your work that way. This is probably the most, sometimes I call it viewer hostile. It's not meant to be hostile, but viewer challenging piece that I've made. It's 4 panels that are 4 by 4 feet square, really, really, really tight black and white lines painted on matte paint. I almost went blind making it. And what happened with the work is that, much like a Bridget Rylett painting, the images would just, they would just flicker, and they would make these optical patterns that are very much like Oriental carpet painting, carpet weaving. They generated, even though it was black and white, they did, the opticality of the work generated color and generated pattern. And in the very center was this little thing that you couldn't see what it was, but of course you're curious, right? So, like, you want to go up and you want to go see what it is. And the closer you got to it, the more optical the line patterns would become, and the more hard it would become for you to focus and see. And so it was this thing that was set up to draw you in and bounce you out, and to point to your own kind of curiosity and voyeurism. Because the images that were in the center of these panels were images of looking into people's apartments and houses at night. So they're images of voyeurism, but you can't really see them because it just becomes such an optical, like, dizzying kind of effect. Everybody knows Bridget Rylett, right? Okay. After that, I started a body of work, which I'm probably the most well-known for, and I always say that when I die, my gravestone will be out of focus. I started a project called the Ground Series, which is about figure and ground and foreground, background, and, you know, all of those kinds of associations. And the first segment of that was based on looking at just simply vernacular photography, the kind of snapshots that you take of your friends on vacation without your friends in it, you know, because I was interested in how we choose. I was watching people photograph each other and, you know, they go like, no, stand over here, stand over there, stand there. It's like the background of an image, a background of a portrait creates the context for how we are to see that person. So, for example, when you look at, the picture of the author at the back of the book of, you know, the book jacket, and it always has the picture of the author. If it's a man, he's usually sitting in front of a library, which tells us he's smart. If it's a woman, it's usually like a flower hedge. but we won't go there. But context, I'm always very interested in the idea of context, because context provides meaning for the subject that's not being depicted. And I wanted to see how this, like, this context, this container, this envelope would presuppose a certain kind of meaning, a certain kind of, you know, a set of assumptions about who that person would be. You know, this would be like a newscaster standing in front of, like, downtown LA talking about, like, the latest riots or something like that. I don't know. I had no particulars in mind. And the sources that I used were, there were images out of magazines and some images that I shot. And this is like dentist wallpaper, I think. And again, I still continue at this point intermixing found imagery with images that I make, and they're printed to be interchangeable, and you can't tell which is which. And then happened, then the crash happened, the last crash happened, where the art market went under, and about 60 to 70% of the galleries in Los Angeles closed, and I was a young, struggling, emerging artist. And I had no gallery, and everything was, it was actually felt worse than this crash did, or this crash is, because it's still going on. And what happened is that artists just, you know, because they didn't have galleries to show in, is they invented a lot of alternative venues. And this particular alternative venue is a quote-unquote gallery called Domestic Setting, and it was a house in Venice, California, Los Angeles, that was a two-bedroom bungalow, and the woman who lived there emptied out the living room and the kitchen and one of the bedrooms of everything and used it as a gallery space, and she just lived in her bedroom, and she ran the gallery as a gallery. And they invited me to do a show based on these background images, and I was really hesitant to do it because all the shows that I'd seen there, artists had gone in and they had pretended it was like the Whitney, you know? Giant paintings, huge sculptures, everything looked bad because it was just a tiny little, you know, 1,200 square foot house at the beach. So it just like never, ever worked. And so I went like, I don't, you know, but then I decided like, well, why not make a project for the space, of the space, in the space, and have this kind of completely like, you know, reflexive kind of scenario going on. And so what I did is I made a group of photographs that I photographed in the space, and some of them are photographed in other empty rooms as well. And I hung them in the house. Each one was a different format, a different size, much the way that, you know, when you go to grandma's house, all the family portraits and, you know, whatever kind of like stuff grandma has is like over the fireplace and in these little like salon style kind of hangings. And so I made these empty background images that were based on looking at the kinds of structures and composition of portrait photography and family portrait photography, and I made them throughout this house. And they are these incredibly empty images. And again, people say they're out of focus, and I keep saying, like, no, I'm not photographing the room. I'm photographing the volume. I'm photographing the negative space. I'm photographing the center of the room where nothing is happening, and you're just looking at the background of what's not there. So then people started talking about me as being the person who's photographing the missing subject, which was a narrative. And yeah. You can't ever get away with it. You know, it's like for every body of work, I figure out like exactly all the misreadings that can happen from my point of view. And I try to make something that just sort of slides in there and undermines the possibility of that. And for the most part, I've managed. But and I manage also by writing very, very short but very, very crisp artist statements that go with every exhibition, because I think it's unfair to assume that the viewer understands what you're doing without any kind of guide to it. I mean, at this stage of my career, I have the history of my career to be the foundation for people to understand what I'm doing. But when I was starting out, I didn't have that. So today I can make a certain kind of image and get away with it and get it, have it understood that I couldn't have made as an emerging artist, because I didn't have the groundwork for that idea to be legible or, you know, acceptable. This was one of the first images that I shot in this series, and it was in my studio, and it just kept bugging me. It just like it was like haunting me, and I couldn't figure out why. And then I figured out that when I was born, my parents were really young, and my dad gave these two reproductions of Vermeer paintings to my mother on their wedding as a wedding present, and they ended up in my bedroom. And they've been in every room I've ever lived in. And I love Vermeer with a passion, not for the sentimentality of the maiden pouring milk into a, you know, bowl, but I can name few painters that can paint light as well as Vermeer. Vermeer is the painter of light like no other. And also the painter of silence and stillness and time and, you know, all of these things that are very dear to my heart. And I can't help but thinking that probably growing up with those two reproductions had something to do with that. They're just ingrained in my mind, you know. They're just, when I shot this image, you know, when I made this image, I had no thinking about the Vermeer image. I didn't even, like, it took me a long time to put the two together. But I think it's just really, like, etched in my psyche. And so there it is. And Vermeer is a very important person to me. Again, not because of the sentimentality of the imagery, but because this incredible, like, silence of the work and this incredible rendition of light. You know, they're all just like they're paintings of light. And Vermeer was not prolific. He made very, very few paintings in his lifetime. He had a zillion children. I don't know how it was ever silent. But if you ever get a chance to see a real Vermeer painting, go see it. There's a few in New York. How many are there, Terry? Like, there's 17 or something like that? There's very, very few. And, I mean, most of them are in Amsterdam, but there are two or three at the Frith in New York. And it's worth going to New York just to go see them. They're just incredible paintings. And so I made an image myself of the two reproductions that I have as the backdrop for something that we don't know what it is. And this is the author's backdrop. And this is where it gets really hard to show the work, because the work becomes so minimal that they're like just white on white, and I'm projecting it, and that's like, I don't know what you can see. You can see very little. But When this work was shown, I had a solo show at Mocha LA, and Mocha LA has the first entrance room is a gigantic room with a huge pyramid skylight, and nothing ever looks good in it because the architecture is so overbearing and so phenomenal that it drowns out the art. Sherry Levine did an installation of her pianos, and they held the space. I can't think of anything else that I've ever seen in there that really held the space. And I wasn't supposed to show in there. I was supposed to show in the other room, and I was installing over the weekend, and I would put all the rejects in the big room, and then I would, like, you know, arrange the little room. And then finally, like, I was taking a break, and I was going, like, everything looks so much better in the big room, you know. But the big room was huge, and my work was, like, as small. It's like, you know, the biggest piece is maybe this big from the series. And I called up the curator, and I said, you know, like, well, come look at this. And she was a good sport, and on a Sunday afternoon drove down to meet me at Mocha, where I was all by myself, and she said, you're absolutely right. And so I installed this giant room with 9 works that were small, and the relationship of the light in the room and the architecture and the work just made this perfect marriage of an installation that was incredible. It's the best that I've ever seen my work look, because it wasn't about just looking at these pictures on a wall. Everybody who came and saw it became aware of the environment, became aware of the light, became aware of the architecture, became aware of the work. And it was this wonderful kind of, like, you know, marriage of things that became about being in the moment, seeing, and really truly being immersed in a visual experience that worked on all levels, where it wasn't just on the wall. You were asking? No. Was that 5 as we have 5 minutes?
A little bit more.
Well, okay. Then there's photo. Then the other fear was like photo. The sort of romantic Julia Margaret Cameron photo out of focus romanticism. And so for that whole body of work, I made a sharp image so it wouldn't, like, you know, that argument was out the door. Okay, we have a problem because I'm on the first body of work out of 7. So we're going to go fast. Camera moves outside. Pardon me? Can't hear. I'm not going to, this is a commission for the Wexner Project, which I'm not going to talk about. We don't have time. The next body of work is called Field, as in color field painting, as in field division, and it's based on cinematic backgrounds. It no longer has the tight composition that the sort of based on portraiture work does. The assumption is that the subject and the camera are both in motion. And I find myself sort of driving around Los Angeles like a location scout for film, and finding locations that are generic and don't have specificity to be identifiable, but yet everybody says, like, oh, I know that's the corner of so-and-so and so-and-so, you know, but it's not. And then as this body of work evolved, what it really became about was photographing atmosphere instead of location. It became, these later images were all photographed in the rain, and they were about just pure atmosphere, and they were very much like Turner paintings of the sky, late Turner sky paintings. And just, you know, about pure atmosphere, no subject, no identifiable location, just This is Chicago, actually. These are giant billboard size pieces that were commissioned for the MCA in Chicago, but if we have 5 minutes, we can't talk about those. Okay. Do you guys want me to slow down or speed up? Because I can do it either way.
Do you want to get to the end or do you want to spend more time here?
So we want to go fast.
Unfortunately.
Okay. This body of work was made with a billboard printing process that sprayed car lacquer, automotive lacquer, onto canvas. And it had, when you looked at it up close, it had this perfect, like, pointillist pattern, and I was incredibly intrigued in the relationship between pointillism and French Impressionism and my own work. You know, what are Monet's haystacks about, but, like, looking at light rather than, they're not about haystacks, they're about looking at light. This is a portfolio I was commissioned to do, which ended up consisting of source material that I had collected in my studio, cut out from magazines and newspapers, and literally was just source material as to, like, you know, what is, like, a background, out of focus background look like, but I thought the images were interesting in themselves.
Are you photographing those, or are they just cut out?
They were cut out, and then they were scanned, and they were printed as waterless lithographs. Next body of work is about peripheral vision, about moving through space and doing the kind of double take that we do when we see something out of the corner of our eye and we turn back. And again, this is just sort of like this flutter of leaf catches your eye and then the camera zooms in on it. I'm skipping over a lot of stuff now. But the remote could. This is one of my favorite images. It's and collectors have, like, the hardest time. They say, but the right-hand panel is, like, just empty paper, right? Like, yeah. It's just walking into this field and, like, you know, nothing is there anymore. That was a commission for the Tate Modern. Nowhere near, I do need to talk about it a little bit. Nowhere Near is a project where I made this decision that I stuck to for 11 years of my life, where I decided that if my work is not about the subject, if my work is not about going out to seek something to photograph, then I shouldn't go out to photograph. I should simply photograph where I happen to be, which happens to be my home. And that's where I spend most of my time. So I made a series of, you know, I probably have like 1,000 negatives photographed over a period of a year, looking out the same window in my living room. And what happened when I got the first proof sheet back was really shocking, because what I see when I look out the window is what the right-hand panel represents, but what's on the proof sheet is what the left-hand panel represents. And what happens is that our brain just erases the window frame for us. You know, we just see through it, we see past it, we don't notice it. But what I got back is all this grid stuff. So I had to go back and make some images photographed from the outside, and, you know, these juxtapositions. And so some of them have the window frame in them and some of them down to sort of articulate that. But so Nowhere Near is all about looking out a window, the same window, for a period of 9 months. And then the next project is called End of Time, and it is about documenting the image that's cast, the light that's casting images on the wall through the same window onto my living room wall. So looking out, looking in. So the house kind of becomes a camera. The window kind of becomes the lens. And it's the most banal kind of imagery of carpets, whatever, you know, just tracing the light, following the light. White blind, bright red is about staring. it's looking at the same tree as the Nowhere Near project, but a little bit more close up, and it's about what happens when you stare at something for a prolonged period of time. I was ill, and I was, like, in bed, and I was staring out the window, and then it became an art idea, and I started making these images where I would stare and stare and stare and stare and stare and stare into this backlit kind of graphic thing, and then I would run to the computer and try to render what the optical after image was. So it's very much about after images. And so, for example, when you look at this black image for a second, and then look at the yellow image, everybody in the gallery swears that there's information printed in the yellow image, but there's not. It's empty. And then there's other images that are just the opposite, where there's information in there, but people swear there isn't. This image is about optical fatigue, about looking at something for so long that it just completely washes out to white, where you no longer see anything, and then you see the after image and it recuperates. This image is about optical memory, about carryover. Like, one image is the background to another image, is the background to another image. So they're all layered on top of each other and then become after images and invert. And then I did The Unforgivable. I not only did I choose a central subject, which I avoided for so long, I chose flowers. And I figured that flowers are so cliche that nobody in their right mind could think that Uta Barth is making art about flowers. Although, as Russell Ferguson, curator at the Hammer Museum, pointed out to me, there's not a single artist he could think of who'd never, like, made a flower, a body of work with flowers in it. I chose flowers because they were so cliché that they couldn't possibly be the subject, but I also chose them because they're the one thing in our lives that are that we have for no other reason than visual pleasure. We may have a really nice couch or, you know, a great new pillow or whatever, but it all has use value. Flowers have no use value. They're a hassle. You bring them home, you put them in a glass, and then after a while they smell, you know? So they're all, the flowers are really truly about visual pleasure and wanting something in your home environment to stop you and engage in something that's of the moment, that is visual, that's of the body, that's of not of the mind entirely. And this is a second installation of that. So if you look at the red image and then you looked on the to the right, if you looked at the white wall, you would see what is on the right-hand side of this image. But I think it's hard to see on the screen. But the work gets sort of looser and looser. Things, you know, they're more and more after images, and I'm interested in how they drift and how they melt and how they disappear and just become like blobs and, you know, lose their definition. And they do it very quickly. If you ever pay attention to after images, which I hope everybody does when they go home tonight or wake up tomorrow morning and there's sunlight, you know, they fade really quickly. And they drift. And for some people, they drift to the left, and for some people, they drift to the right. I don't know what that means. And these are images like that are pure white, so you can't even see the edges of them. Sundial, 2007. Big installation shots. This is a body of work that was designed to... It used the house as a sundial, and it traced the imagery, the very, very, very last seconds of the day where the sun kind of, or the setting of the sun erased the imagery that's cast into my house. You'll notice that I have no artwork on my walls. It's like I have all blank walls. Number one, because I can't think when I have art on the wall. Number two, I can't make art when I'm, you know, it's because that's where I work. This is an image, when you look at it, it's like the light is just like becomes liquid and pours down the wall because it's being refracted through this carafe of water. And they're just these sort of casual, really humble observation. And then there are these images that start appearing that are both positive and negative, you know, both positive imagery and after image, negative imagery, and how can that be? And the answer to that is that they become a certain kind of hallucinogenic kind of imagery, a hallucinogenic kind of way of seeing, a way that lets go of that sort of, that rigorous kind of logic of documentation and plays with other ways of perception. That when you spend a lot of time sitting around staring at nothing as I do, you start seeing. And again, you know, these are, this is like my living room floor, you know, and the corner of the wall to the kitchen. It's like, and some of them are just really subtle. There's hardly any information, and then the sun goes below the horizon and things just disappear. And then what happened is I had to move studios. Oh, no, this is, okay, one more body of work. I photographed in the house for 10, 11 years and suddenly felt claustrophobic and felt like I had to go outside. And but how to go outside if you're not looking for a subject? And so my solution was to simply point the camera at the floor and follow my own shadow, and point the camera up into the sky with a certain sense of, like, awe, visual awe in the sky. And out in my neighborhood, I have a lot of trees in my neighborhood. Never have any destination to the work. You never know, you're never going anywhere. You're just simply walking. And you're looking up and you're looking down, but you're not looking forward towards that sort of, you know, photo subject.
So is the down shot the same spot when you're looking up?
In some cases, not. It's not important to me that it be, like, identical. Wait, this is a good one. An image I like a lot. You know, and this is like the first image is, again, it's an after image. It's a negative of what you would see. And I like the clumsiness of it. And then what happened is I had to move out of a studio that I'd been in for 20 years, and I had all these boxes of stuff that I never unpacked, and suddenly I unpacked this box that was full of photographs that I made as an undergraduate. And I made them, and I never showed them in class. They have no pinholes in them. They were never shown to friends. They were never shown in critique. They were never shown, period. But looking at them, they have a certain kind of relevance to a project called Sundial. I'm having a hard time with a projector now. But basically, this is just a project of tracing the entire day with my own shadow. And, you know, when I was making this work, I was in school and I was learning about Edward Weston and I was learning about Minor White, and whatever this was about, you know, was not part of any kind of discussion, so I never showed it. And then the second piece is called Every Day, where I masked out an area in my studio and I would make a photograph every day of what occurred in that place while I was making other art. Yes, and I have a cat. Had a cat. 90s are just, and you know, and this is just like, it's interesting to me to see that at the age of 21, I was making images where all the information is pushed to the edge. This is a self-portrait, but I'm not really in it. You know, it's empty. Again, it's empty, the center. So I have all of these images that I was making in my early 20s, you know, as an undergraduate student, that were about this empty center, and the information just pushed off to the edge, and about this sort of peripheral kind of thing. This is the snow scene. I have no idea how I photographed it. Where are my footprints? I'm walking around this bush, but there's no, you know. And then this is the last image. And I did it in 5 minutes, almost. Any questions? Yeah.
Are you involved in the darkroom process? Is that part of your process heavily or not?
I used to be. The darkroom process doesn't exist anymore. Everything is digital now. You can't even find a darkroom if you try to. I know Photoshop well enough to get images to look the way that I want to, and then I give them to somebody who is more skilled at Photoshop than I am to do the production quality version of what I'm looking for, because you can spend your life learning Photoshop. It's a really deep software. And I don't want to be a technician. I want to be an artist. So the darkroom is really gone. You can't buy film anymore. You can't buy paper anymore. It's like, you know, it's gone. Judy Fiskin made this really wonderful film about the end of photography. And I think that's what it called, the end of photography. Of like everything, you know, like developing reels and all of this kind of stuff, you know. It's like shaking liquids in the dark. It's just like, it's gone. Everything is digital, you know. And I just 2 weeks ago bought my first digital camera after having only one camera my entire career, which was just a workhorse, really simple Pentax 6x7 camera. So I used to print all my own work, and then, you know, when it got to be larger color work, I didn't have access to a large color processor. I would work with labs, and now I just, it's all digital, and I work with somebody who is really attuned to what I do. Yeah.
The piece you showed that had what looked like a completely blank piece of white paper, mm-hmm. it was side by side.
Mm-hmm.
Is the white paper part of it, is it, I guess I'd like to just know sort of a little more context about that to understand your thinking about it. Like, did you literally just take a blank piece of paper and frame it, or is it in any way processed like the other photo as sort of like a detail from that photo or a different perspective?
The camera just simply moves forward. It's a landscape scene, and you see the wires and you see the ground first, and then you move further into the landscape and you no longer see that. So it's just simply like an image without any information identifiable. Yeah.
20 years ago, when you would be insulted with one of the questions about beauty, what would you say? I mean, how would you address beauty, since your pictures are nice looking, but it's not something you really talked about tonight?
I would talk about the reason that beauty was a dirty word, and the reasons for why beauty was a dirty word is that we were coming out of beauty was thrown out the window with conceptual art, because conceptual art was about ideas and beauty was just like distraction and frosting. And beauty was thrown out the window with in early postmodernism and, you know, deconstructive work and post, you know, just all this sort of kind of politically oriented work, because again, it was like not part of the message. It was like a distraction from it. And there was no interest in the engagement of viewing. There was an interest in meaning and how meaning is made. And so I would talk about the history of how beauty came in and out, in and out of Vogue in art throughout history. Anybody else?
I hear a sadness about, you know, the digital photography taking over. And I'd like to know how you brought yourself to that point to buying your first digital camera and how has it changed?
You hear a sadness in me about it?
It seems like you've lost a friend. Or, you
know, well, it's because I don't know how to use the damn thing. and that's really the only thing. It's, I mean, there is a sadness about, you know, there are qualities that photographic materials in the darkroom could do that cannot be replicated with a digital, no matter what you do. But then on the other hand, there are digital things that can happen that can't be replicated in the darkroom. So, you know, ideally, you know, I mean, I was head faculty in a art department, and we decided to keep both alive, you know, and to keep, like, to build the digital area and to preserve the darkroom facility, because we felt that the darkroom was important, and it offers possibilities that, you know, the digital doesn't, and the digital is so removed. On the other hand, I don't have to come home smelling like Fixer all day long, so it's like, you know, it's like nice. But really, it's I'm like, some people, a lot of photographers are real, like, you know, photo gearheads, and I'm like, not. It's just like, tell me what button to push and that's it. I don't want to, like, you know, I'm not like enamored by like photo tech talk. And so this digital camera sitting in my house has been used by my studio assistants and not by me.
Well, I, for one, am encouraged, because I dropped out of digital groups because I was being barraged by read the book. And I was not enjoying taking the pictures, you know, as much. So I just do my own thing and I don't worry about reading the book.
Which book are you supposed to read?
Digital book.
Oh, the digital book.
It comes with the camera.
I don't even know if mine came with a book. I think mine came without a book. I think the book is online, is the answer. I asked. It's online. Anybody else? Well, thank you so much for coming. I really appreciate it.